Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you on this Thursday afternoon. We got Jimmy Akin with us. So if you're going to dial, you better dial now because you know those phones fill up quickly when Jimmy's here. 888-318-7884. It's Ask Me Anything About the Catholic Faith today with Jimmy. 888-318-7884. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call. Whatever your question is, you're welcome to call. And when I say whatever your question is, that counts double. When Jimmy's here, whatever. He'll talk to you about whatever you want to talk about. Jimmy Akin, of course, the senior apologist here and a very fine author, but also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular corners of the podcast world. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. What's dropping tomorrow in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, you'll be appearing on the show because it's a fifth Friday, and that means it's Weird Questions Day. And so we're going to be talking about, can Padre Pio still absolve penitents even though he's in heaven? Could a Catholic couple get married without a priest if civilization collapses? what is the realm of Sheol in the Bible? Are speaking in tongues and resting in the spirit genuine phenomena, and more?
All right. All right. Weird questions tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I hope the music will be on there, but I don't know. I don't know if it is, but I hope it is. If you've got a question, weird or otherwise, you're welcome to call here and ask Jimmy, 888-318-7884. You've been getting around a bit. You've been putting miles on that truck of yours. And
yep.
I just want to ask you about Saturday night, because I'm a big fan of Catholic radio, as you probably know. And so you're doing a fundraiser for Catholic Radio Saturday night?
Yes. There's a group of folks in Little Rock who are trying to raise the funds to have a Catholic radio station in central Arkansas at the Capitol that will serve the central part of the state. And they're putting on a fundraiser this weekend. I'm going to be speaking Saturday night at St. Andrew's Cathedral. Or St. Andrew's Hall at the Cathedral in Little Rock. I'm going to be telling my conversion story and answering questions for people and talking about the importance of Catholic radio.
Wonderful. I'm so glad that it just keeps growing and growing. And good luck with that. I mean, I hope that goes well.
Thank you.
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. That's one of the cool things about Catholic radio. Just people get the idea and they start putting something together. And time and time again, we see it successful. So lots of success for that effort. Let's start with Christopher in Connecticut, where they recently got Catholic radio. Just a few years ago, Catholic radio came to Connecticut. He's listening on the app, however, on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Christopher. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question was whether or not it's morally acceptable to act on what they call a doubting conscience, even if the thing isn't that you're doing is not strictly necessary. There's many things that are unnecessary that you could have doubts about.
Well, so this is a common, now, Christopher, I don't know if this is the case with you or not, but this tends to come up with folks who are scrupulous, because you will find some older moralistic textbooks that will say things like, it's a sin to act on a doubtful conscience, where you're not sure what the right thing to do is. And those textbooks are not written for people with scrupulosity, and they're not talking about the kind of situations people normally get into. What's typically missing from discussions of this nature is the gravity of the ethical decision in question and the need to act, because you can achieving absolute certainty is not always achievable in this life, and there can be a need to act. Now, sometimes that need to act is urgent. Like, let's suppose you're in a building and it's a burning building, and you don't know whether to try to get down the fire escape because the fire escape is looking kind of rickety, it may not hold, or whether the thing to do is like flee through the interior of the building, which you know is on fire. And you've got to make a choice, because if you don't, then the smoke is going to overcome you. You're going to go unconscious and the flames will get you. So you've got to make a choice urgently, and you're not sure which is the best choice to make. Well, in that case, you just got to make the best choice you can based on your impression and do it. In other situations, though the need to make the choice is not as urgent, but also the stakes are not as urgent. So let's put ourselves in the mind of a scrupulous person for a minute. Let's suppose you're trying to decide what to eat for dinner. And at the moment, you're being scrupulous about, should I have pizza or should I have chicken? And you're worried about which one is the right ethical decision. Well, the truth is you can have either one. But for a scrupulous person, it may not be obvious that you can have either one. Scrupulous people can get tied into knots about all kinds of ethical decisions that they're making harder than they need to be. But the truth is, whichever you pick, you need to eat. And so even though you're doubtful about, well, which is technically the better, the stakes are so low. It is not going to be a mortal sin if you pick the wrong one. So just go ahead and make a choice and have your dinner. So there, in order to apply the principle that you're not supposed to act on a doubtful conscience, that applies in completely different situations than the ones I just talked about. It's like, suppose you're in the woods and you're going hunting and you see a movement in the bushes and you think it might be a buck, but you're not sure if it's a buck. It might be another hunter. Do you act on a doubtful conscience in this situation? Heck no. You make sure that it is a buck and not another human being before you shoot at it. So that's the kind of situation where this rule applies. It does not apply to emergency situations where a decision needs to be made quickly. It does not apply to trivial situations where a decision needs to be made in order to get on with life and stopping oneself from obsessing about minor matters. So that's kind of a general sketch of how I'd approach that. Is that helpful to you?
Yes, that is very helpful. Thank you.
Well, Chris, no problem. Thank you for getting us started today. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. John's in Texas watching on YouTube. Welcome, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Mr. Akin. My question today is, does God violate the Pauline principle which states that one should not do evil to bring about good? So James Sturba argues that God, by creating the natural laws which result in natural evil, is an example of God doing evil to bring about good. How would you respond to his argument?
Okay, well, I haven't heard his argument from him, so I mean, there could be something that gets lost in translation, so I can't comment on it directly. What I can comment on is what you related to me. Could you state it again? Paul says that we're not to do evil, that good may result. And what is the proposed evil that God is doing in order to achieve a good?
By creating the natural laws, Sturba says, which result in natural evils. Like A causes B, and then B causes C, therefore A is the cause of C.
Okay, I need to clarify what we mean by natural law in this case, because that term is used in more than one way. Sometimes when people talk about natural law, they're referring to principles that we see operating in non-human nature, like gravity or the principles of geology that result in earthquakes or things like that. On the other hand, the term natural law in theology is often used to refer to the law we see written in human nature. So things like don't murder, don't commit adultery. Which way are you envisioning this?
The natural conditions of the universe.
Okay. So any evils that occur in the natural order of things, meaning outside of human nature, are physical evils. And they are therefore not moral evils. And physical evils, like pain and things like that, can be tolerated for a sufficient purpose. It's not wrong. You know, if let's suppose Cy has broken his arm. He's and in order to set it, I'm the only person who's there. And so I need to yank on it to get it snapped back into position so we can properly bind it up and let it heal. Well, it would be morally wrong of me to inflict the pain of yanking his arm for no reason. But if I'm yanking his arm to get it back into position so that it can heal properly, then that physical evil of the pain is tolerable. And it's not only not a sin, it's a good thing. to get Psy into a position where his arm can heal. So when things like earthquakes happen, it will be a physical evil for some creatures. You know, like let's say you're a star-nosed mole. You know, if you've never seen a star-nosed mole, look them up because, wow, they are weird looking. But let's say you're a star-nosed mole and you're down in your little mole burrow, and an earthquake happens and your mole burrow collapses on you. Well, okay, that's an evil, but it doesn't mean it's doing nobody any good. Suppose you're the star-nosed mole and you die. Well, okay, you're dead, but you know, it's an ill wind that blows that does nobody any good. So even though you're dead, guess what? You're worm food now. Literally, there are going to be worms that get to survive and thrive because now they get to eat you, whereas you would have moved out of the way if they tried that while you were alive. So there is actually, it may be bad for the mole, but it's good for the worms. And so God does bring about goods from every single evil that are equal or greater in value to the harm that was caused by the evil. And that's true both of moral evils like sin and of physical evils like pain or death. So no, God is not violating the principle of let us do evil in order that good may come. What Paul's talking about is not physical evil, it's moral evil. Paul is saying we are not to sin, which is a moral evil, in order to accomplish good. But Paul wouldn't have a problem causing physical evil in order to produce a good. Paul, if I wasn't here to set Cy's arm, but St. Paul was, he wouldn't have a problem. In fact, St. Paul was a kind of rough and tumble guy. He would have less of a problem yanking on Cy's arm to get it back into position than I would, because I know Cy, I'm going to be sympathetic, but Paul is rough and tumble. It's just yank there. Okay, your arm is back in position now. So Paul is not talking about physical evils in this case. He's talking about moral evils.
John, I hope that was helpful for you. Thank you very much. I do remember I broke my toe swimming once, and the doctor had to do that, had to pull on the...
Yep.
Oh, I didn't like that at all. All right, yeah. We'll take a quick break. I'm really glad that St. Paul wasn't there to do it, though. Right after this, more Jimmy Akin coming up on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, his upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, Monday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and television.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Lines full as can be. They can't get any fuller. Emma, our friend, is in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. Hi, Emma. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Really good, thanks.
I do have a question. Good. Mm-hmm. So I know angels and demons don't have physical bodies, so when they fight each other, what does that look like?
It looks like a monster truck rally, you know, with mud. It looks like a big monster truck rally in the mud.
Thanks for calling, Emma. We'll talk to you again sometime. Bye.
Okay, so the answer is we don't see any on-camera battles, with kind of one exception in Scripture, to where humans perceive angels and demons fighting. We're told about such battles. You know, like when Gabriel shows up after Daniel's been fasting for 3 weeks, he says, sorry, I'm late, but the Prince of Persia detained me. And right now, Michael's got him in a headlock. He doesn't say headlock, but Michael's holding him right now while I come and give you this message. But we don't see that happen on camera. So the Bible doesn't give us any indications of how humans would be able, of what humans would perceive if they were able to perceive the invisible reality of an angel and a demon having a fight. But because of the way the ancient Hebrew mind worked, they were familiar with battles that were between soldiers that had armor and shields and weapons like swords and spears and stuff. And so if an ancient Israelite was allowed to perceive a battle between an angel and a demon, they would probably perceive it that way. They would apply the ordinary images of warfare to the warfare that was happening between an angel and a demon, or a group of angels and a group of demons. So that's how they probably would have perceived it. What about someone coming from a different cultural context? Well, I'm from a different cultural context, and although I know about ancient warfare, I've also seen other representations of warfare. I'm a fan of the TV show Babylon 5 that has telepaths. And in one episode of Babylon 5, they have a scene where these two telepaths are kind of mentally wrestling with each other. They're sitting across a table from each other, and one of them is attacking the other. And telepathically, they show the audience a special effect of what another telepath sees happening. And they see these kind of dark tendrils coming out from one of the telepaths and trying to poke holes in the shield, the mental shield that the other telepath has up, which looks kind of like crystal. And this is related to the shadows and Vorlon symbolism on the show. But because I've seen that as an image of mental fighting, I might perceive an angelic conflict along similar lines. I might see that kind of imagery. Or since I've just proposed a monster truck rally, I might see a monster truck rally. The truth is that there's no physical imagery associated with this combat because angels don't have physical bodies. And so when they fight, it's telepathic, and there's no way to represent that in physical terms except by using some kind of metaphor or analogy. And the metaphor or analogy that you see is going to be dependent on your cultural background and how you envision warfare.
Thanks. I got it.
All right, Emma. Thanks. Look forward to talking with you again sometime. Let's go to Fargo, North Dakota. Charles is in Fargo listening on Real Presence Radio. Charles, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Si. Hey, Jimmy.
Hi, Charles.
I have a Lutheran friend who's in my Bible study, and we were talking about sin and repentance. And in his church, their belief is that every sin is mortal sin. And he mentioned that with having venial and mortal, it kind of has a lot of gray spots. So my question is how do you clearly differentiate between mortal and venial sins?
Okay, so actually in his church, if he's in any kind of standard Lutheran church, what he's saying, assuming he used those words, because I didn't hear him say it, but if he said that every sin is mortal, he's mistaken. Because by definition, what a mortal sin is it's one that kills the spiritual life in your soul and takes you out of a state of grace. And Lutherans do not believe that every sin does that. In fact, classically, Lutheranism would say that only the sin of apostasy, abandoning the Christian faith, only apostasy will do that. So what he likely means, because this is another common element in some Protestant preaching, is to say that every sin is gravely sinful. So you get considerable agreement with among many Protestants, not all of them, but you do have Protestants, including in the Lutheran tradition, who would say every sin is gravely sinful and would be worth getting damned over, but God will not in fact damn you for it. So it's not really a mortal sin, it's just a grave sin. From a Catholic perspective, in order for something to be a mortal sin, three conditions must be met. The first condition is there has to be grave matter. And not all sins have grave matter. It's just unrealistic to say that stealing a penny from a millionaire is the same as stealing $100 from a person who is poor and only has $100. Those are two different acts. Stealing a penny from a millionaire is not grave matter. And there's coherence with what Scripture says on this, because if you read 1 John is clear that some sins are grave enough that they can cost you your salvation. But he's also aware that we commit other sins that just aren't that grave. He says, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. We also read in the New Testament, we all stumble in many ways. But that doesn't mean that each stumble is a plummet off of a cliff. And so the New Testament recognizes sins have different gravity. They are not all grave. The second condition that has to be met for a sin to become mortal is you have to have full knowledge of its moral character. So you have to know that this is mortal, you have to know that this is a grave sin. And the third condition that has to be met is you have to give it deliberate consent. It's not like you did it under psychological pressure. It's not like you did it under, you know, reflexively or, you know, kind of a spur of the moment without thinking about it theme. You have to knowingly and deliberately choose to do something that you know is grave matter. Now, if you do that, if you say, I know that this is gravely displeasing to God, I know that, and I just don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. Well, then you are excluding love for God from your soul because you love this other thing more than you love God. And consequently, that is something that will result in you not being spiritually alive anymore, and you'll need to repent. But that's the Catholic understanding of mortal sin. And if you want to read about those conditions, they're right there in the Catechism of the Catholic Church for you, which is online. And you can look up the passage and show your friend and say, well, this is how we understand it.
Charles, thanks. I hope that's helpful to you. I'm going to head on to Cleveland, Texas now. Jace is in Texas watching on YouTube. Welcome, Jace. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, it's an honor to talk to both y'all, man. Y'all have no idea. Oh. I've been watching y'all's show for like months now, almost a year at this point. I love y'all. Y'all are incredible. God bless y'all's ministry.
Well, thank you, Jace.
You're very kind. Yeah.
That's very nice.
You've taught me so much, and I love you both so much. Y'all are awesome. Today was my last day as a sophomore at my high school, and my Spanish teacher, he never really talked to me about like theology all that much at all, right? But yesterday, my friends got into a little dispute with him a little bit, and one of them was like, we need Jason here and stuff. And so I guess that made him feel the need during my first period, the class he has me in, to bring up God and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so his view was that we're all God, right? And I now know what he was referring to. It's John 10, verse 34, but I didn't even know that verse existed, which shows some ignorance on my part. I should have known that. I've read John. I just don't recall that at all. But he tried claiming that we are all God and stuff. And so obviously I pressed him on that. I was like, okay, then create something. You know, I pressed him on stuff. I didn't really joke. I was a little pressed about it because he was getting a little pressed too. But so yeah, I just wanted y'all's understanding of the word Elohim, right? Because I do know about it. And I do know it doesn't always mean that it doesn't always refer to the one true God, right? It can refer to other things. And I know that's what Jesus is talking about, right?
So you,
in that verse, whenever he calls us, he says, is it not written, you are all gods, right? So
okay.
Go ahead.
Jimmy?
Okay, so technically what Jesus says is it not written? Because what's under discussion is Jesus blaspheming God by claiming to be equal with God? So, you know, they're accusing him of blasphemy for effectively saying that he's God. And he responds by saying, whoa, hold your horses. Even in your own law, it's written that there's a passage where it says you are all gods. And that passage is Psalm 82. Which depicts God standing in the council of the gods and accusing the other gods of wrongdoing. And Jesus says, without commenting on exactly what that psalm means, he refers to how the Jewish scriptures refer to even those to whom the word of God came as gods. And so what he's showing is that the term God can be used for beings other than God. And that happens even in the Jewish scriptures. Now, he's carefully avoiding the question of, well, what are these other gods? And there's a difference of opinion about that. Some people think that they're judges, that they're just human judges. I'm skeptical of that. I think it's talking about other heavenly beings, which we would call angels, but in the ancient world were often thought of as lesser gods. Having said that, the term Elohim has a variety of meanings, or in its singular form, El, has a variety of meanings. It can apply to the one true God, the creator of everything. It can apply to lesser spiritual beings like angels. It can even apply to the departed souls of humans, because when Samuel's soul shows up, the medium of Endor identifies Samuel as an Elohim, and he's a human. So really, the term Elohim refers to any inhabitant of the spiritual world, whether it's a low-level one like a human soul, a middle-level one like an angel, or a high-level one like the Supreme Creator.
Thanks, Jace. Got to take a break. Right back. Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore. Visit whyweirecatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
A little bit of groovy music for you on this Thursday afternoon. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And you can ask him anything. It's an Ask Me Anything edition of Catholic Answers Live. The number is 888-318-7884. And we're coming right here to California. Jay is here in California watching on YouTube. Thanks for waiting, Jay. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I got a comment on that music. That was awesome.
Thank you.
I had a question. So, yeah, of course. So I guess disclaimer before I ask the question, I have an extreme bias, both personally because of my, upbringing. I'm from a divorced household, as well as just culturally. It breaks my heart seeing so many people attacking marriage. And so I find myself when I'm getting in conversations with other Catholics who are not as, as emphatic about pursuing marriage, especially earlier on in one's life, you know, they typically say, "Oh, you know, you got to be careful not to make it an idol." And I just get defensive, and so I just wanted to say, or wanted to ask, what's a good baseline to turn to? Just an objective baseline where we can say, "Okay, yeah, at this point, it becomes idolatrous," and below it. It's just respectful and reverent.
Okay. Well, now there is a, okay, so fundamentally what idolatry is treating something that is not God as if it is God. And so if you care about your marriage more than you care about God, that's idolatry. Now, what form would that take? It could take a variety of different forms, because the real idolatry is going on in a person's heart. And that means that there's no single manifestation externally of how this idolatry of marriage might work. It could take a variety of different forms. Like, let's suppose you knew that you had a grave duty to worship God, let's say, and your spouse objects to you worshiping God ever under any circumstances. You are never to worship God. Well, if you care about your wife more than you care about God, then you might say, okay, well, I guess I won't ever worship God in any way. I care about my marriage more than I care about God. Well, okay, that would be idolatry. But that's just one example. If you look at any particular scenario and you say, well, if God required me to do something, you know, else, would I refuse to do that for the sake of my marriage? And if the answer is no, you would not refuse to do what God commands for the sake of your marriage, then you are not committing idolatry. Also, one has to be realistic about what, you know, God would actually require you to do that would be contrary to your marriage. Because as St. Paul says, we're called to live in peace. And that means that he says it specifically in a marriage context in the Corinthian correspondence. And so he recognizes, and the New Testament acknowledges, there are compromises that have to be made in marriage. And that doesn't displease God, even if it's not the ideal. So if you had, there are situations like where a person, let's say they're married to a non-Catholic, and the non-Catholic insists on not going to Mass on Sundays. Well, as sad as that is and as undesirable as that is, there can be situations where a Catholic may not be able to go to Mass for an extended period in order to maintain domestic peace. That's not the same thing as caring more about the marriage than they care about God. So there has to be careful discernment in these cases, but the fundamental principle is you're not gravely guilty of idolatry unless you're putting something else above God.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Jay, thank you very much for the call and for the question. It's open. Well, we used to say open forum, and then we got fancier.
It's habit.
And it's just for habit. It comes out, but we call it Ask Me Anything now. And we're going to Denver, Colorado. Gambino in Denver, Colorado, listening on 1120 AM. Glad you're here, Gambino. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, guys. I'm going to this Bible study here in Denver, and they're saying that Moses was ascended to heaven or taken to heaven because his tomb is nowhere to be found, and because the devil and Michael were fighting for his body. So was he taken to heaven?
Well, the truth is we don't know. There is a reference. Now, at the end of Deuteronomy, it says that nobody knows where Moses was buried. And that implies he was buried. In the New Testament, we have a verse in the book of Jude, and Jude is like the highest density of mysterious things in a row. It's a very short book. It's the second shortest book in the New Testament, maybe third shortest, but it has a bunch of mysterious things in it. And one of them is Jude refers to something to some event where Michael was in conflict with the devil, and he says that they were disputing over the body of Moses. And Michael didn't directly condemn Satan, but he said, "May the Lord rebuke you," which is the thing that Jude is interested in. He's wanting people not to slander celestial beings. It's like, leave that up to God. And so he cites Michael as an example of doing this. The problem is, where is this coming from? There have been attempts to find a parallel to this in the Old Testament, but the details aren't an exact match. And so it's hard to tell, is he, maybe he's referring to this Old Testament thing, but maybe he's not. And there are some early Christian writers that say, like Origen, I believe, is one of them, that say he's referring to an incident that is recounted in a non-canonical book known as The Assumption of Moses. Well, we have part of a book called The Assumption of Moses, but part of it's missing. And the incident, if this incident was from that book, it's from a part that we don't have. So we're not sure exactly what Jude is referring to here. And there's not much of a way to clarify it. It could be by referring to the body of Moses. I mean, that in its most natural sense would be taken as a reference to the physical body of Moses. And maybe there was a conflict between St. Michael and the devil in this book. And maybe St. Michael won and took Moses's body up to heaven where his spirit is or something. But we're not really sure. You might guess that based on the fact this book was called The Assumption of Moses. It kind of sounds like Moses was assumed, but that's not necessarily the only way to take it. The body of Moses could be understood in a kind of more metaphorical sense, like the body of Christ is a reference not just to Christ's physical body, but also a reference to the church. And so I know some folks have said, well, maybe the body of Moses is a reference to Israel as a whole. And so the fundamental bottom line is it's unclear exactly what's being referred to here. It is possible that this book referred to Moses being assumed into heaven after his death, but it's also possible that that's not what happened. And if the book, even if, since this is a non-canonical book, even if it refers to Moses being assumed bodily into heaven, that doesn't mean it's right. Because it's non-canonical. It's not guaranteed to be true. So we can't really say much more than what Deuteronomy says, which is nobody knows where Moses' tomb was. It's possible he could have been assumed, but it's also possible that something else happened, and it's possible that Jude could be using this as a literary allusion. Like if I said to Cy, oh, well, as Sherlock Holmes said, when you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. I can say that and use it to make a point in conversation with Cy, even though Sherlock Holmes didn't really exist. And in the same way, Jude could use this passage about Michael and the devil to make a point, i.e. don't slander celestial beings, without implying that this incident actually happened. He could be making a literary reference the same way I can make literary references with Sherlock Holmes.
Okay,
got it. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an Ask Me Anything Catholic edition with Jimmy Akin this hour. 888-3187-884 is the number. The big Catholic conference is coming up in September, and so it's time to invite you to it. As you plan, we do it the last full weekend of September each year. This year, that's September 26th through 29th. It's our 10th annual conference, and it's called Learn From Me, the Parables, Sermons, and Conversations of Jesus Christ. And who'd you like to hear talking about the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ? Certainly, Jimmy Akin would be among them, and he will be one of the speakers. Tim Staples will be one of the speakers. All of our apologists here will be speakers. We'll do the radio show there. We'll do all kinds of other fun things. But then Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn will be there, Father Sebastian Walsh, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Dr. William Junker. It's going to just be a great time as we dig in to what Jesus says to us in the Gospels. The place to go to find out all about it is CatholicAnswersConference.com. Just visit CatholicAnswersConference.com. We'd love it if you would come. Back to the phones we go. Yasha is in Iowa, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Yasha.
Hi, thank you. My husband and I have been married for 10 years. We were both baptized Catholic and confirmed, but in all that time, we didn't go to church. We weren't really practicing Catholics. So when we were married, it was by a Lutheran pastor who just happened to be a family friend. But now we're back, and we're going to church, and we're going to confession, and receiving communion. And our deacon suggested we get our marriage convalidated. So my question is, should we be abstaining from intercourse until that day, and would it be a sin if we did not? And also, what about the last 10 years?
Okay, so the way church law is written, your marriage— your current marriage would not be regarded, since I assume there were not extenuating circumstances like no priest was available to marry you and you didn't have a dispensation from observing the Catholic form of marriage. And so the ordinary law would apply to you, that is, people who had been received, you've been married 10 years, so the current law was in effect. And the way the current law is written, your existing marriage would not have come into reality. It would not be valid in the church's eyes, and therefore you should live as brother and sister until you're able to get the convalidation. That's the way the laws are written. Now, in terms of do you need to refrain from communion? Well, if you go to confession and you confess all your sins, and you're absolved, then you can continue to receive communion as if you're living as brother and sister. In terms of how to regard the previous 10 years of marriage and all the relations you had in that time, I would assume you were in good conscience. And, you know, unless one of you for a fact knew we're in an invalid marriage, then you were doing what you thought was appropriate in the circumstances, and that means you were not knowingly and deliberately committing a gravely immoral act. And so you did not commit a mortal sin by your relations because you didn't know how the church would regard your situation. And so in my judgment, you wouldn't, as long as that was the case, you wouldn't need to confess it because it was not a mortal sin. You might want to confess it anyway and just say, we had this marriage. We didn't realize it was invalid. We've been living as husband and wife, but now we're living as brother and sister. That would, you could mention that in confession if you wanted, but as long as you didn't realize that that you were doing something that you shouldn't be doing, it wouldn't have been a mortal sin and it doesn't need to be confessed. In terms of where to go from here, the good news is it's very easy to get your marriage convalidated. I not had a situation back when I was married, when my wife was alive, that was similar. And we had a convalidation. It wasn't the same, but it was similar. And we had a convalidation. It was very easy. It took like 5 minutes after a mass one day. We had two witnesses, a priest, and we were done. And so it's very easy to get your marriage convalidated.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you very much, Yasha, for the call. The number here is 888-3187-884. Lines continue full. John is in Gainesville, Florida, watching on YouTube. Welcome, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, hello. Jimmy, I had the question. If God is beyond space and time, and everything is as a present now to him, could the bread and wine, which was given to Abraham in the book of Genesis by Melchizedek, been the Eucharist?
So this would require God to transubstantiate the bread and wine that Melchizedek brought out to give to Abraham, and even though Christ had not yet gone to the cross. Well, okay, we have good evidence that God can do that. Number one, because he's omnipotent and he can do whatever he wants. And he can do anything as long as it doesn't involve a logical contradiction. And there's no obvious logical contradiction here. It's not like Melchizedek has given Abraham a four-sided triangle. You know, that would be a logical contradiction. God couldn't make Melchizedek do that. But we also have good evidence that Christ doesn't have to go to the cross yet, because this is based on God doing a miracle. It's not based on the fact that Christ has gone to a cross yet. It's not like God got more omnipotent when Christ went to the cross. He was as omnipotent as he'd always been. And we have the fact that Christ himself consecrated the Eucharist at the Last Supper before he went to the cross. So if God can do that, if he can have Christ consecrate the Eucharist before the cross, then he could hypothetically have Melchizedek consecrate the Eucharist before Christ goes to the cross, even though it's 1,800 years earlier instead of 18 hours earlier. Having said that, I think it's logically possible God could bring this about, but as always, when we're considering possibilities, we have to say, what evidence do we have that this actually took place, that this possibility was an actuality? And I don't think we have any evidence for this. I would put this in the category of, yeah, it's possible, but it's purely speculative, and it's not supported by any evidence we have.
That makes sense to you?
Yes, it John. Does. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank so you much. For the call. Let's go to Dominic in Ohio, listening on Annunciation Radio. Dominic, thank you for the call. Go ahead with... Oh, hang on. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I was wondering if, in the interest of saving the unborn, it would be morally, if it would be moral for someone to, for the scientific community to pursue research into artificial wombs and things like that, or mm-hmm. if that would be a breach of the natural law.
Well, I actually recently, I wrote a paper on church teaching on what the magisterium has said about embryo adoption. And it's going to be published in an anthology that the National Catholic Bioethics Center is putting out. And I actually touched on this question in the essay I wrote, because it has been proposed, well, like, what could you do with snowflake embryos, you know, children that have been abandoned in storage facilities in fertility clinics? Could you, for example, save them by putting them in an artificial womb? And the magisterium has not yet answered that question, and it's ultimately for the magisterium to answer. But I can tell you my opinion. My opinion is we're already doing this, because we've had incubators since at least the 1800s. And incubators are generation one artificial wombs. They are alternative technological means of keeping a baby alive when it cannot be contained in its own mother's womb for whatever reason. And so the church has never had a problem with incubators, and incubators have gotten more and more sophisticated over time. But basically, incubators are generation one artificial wombs. And if we come up with more sophisticated incubators that can take care of babies earlier and earlier, even from the point of conception, then in order to save human life, I would say, yeah, you can use those incubators, and they'd just be called artificial wombs at that point, but they're the same fundamental thing. The only difference is how early a baby is able to be put in one in order to save its life.
So, Dominic, go ahead and get to work.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the advice and your opinion. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, Dominic. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. Christina is in Charleston, South Carolina, listening on 7:30 a.m. Welcome, Christina. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. My understanding from the Catholic perspective is that all of the angels were created at one time. They had the option whether to accept their what God wanted them to do or not. And thereafter, they cannot change their mind. Mm-hmm. And so I was reading Genesis 6, and it talks about giants. That mm-hmm. took me into research in the book of Enoch, which gives an explanation for those giants. And the book of Enoch, while it's not in the Bible, it's referenced, and it's talked about by the early church fathers.
And referenced in Jude.
Implies, yes. But I'm saying the book itself is not in the Bible.
Right.
But it implies that these angels came to help humanity and then changed mm-hmm. and decided to mm-hmm. corrupt humanity. And to me, that just sounds heretical, not even mm-hmm. plausible. So mm-hmm. I know the church's understanding or explanation of giants has changed, but I'd like mm-hmm. to better understand how it could even be possible that we would talk about there being demons having intercourse with humans, because demons don't have bodies, they're spirits.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess I have a few points that I should make in this regard. And hang on just a second, I'm going to look up something real quick for you. So the Genesis 6 passage is one of the more mysterious ones in the Bible, because the author is alluding to something that the ancient audience knew about, but he doesn't say hardly anything about it. And that means it's hard for modern readers to figure out what it means. Now, the most common opinion in recent centuries has been that Genesis 6 is referring to human beings as the sons of God. They might be righteous people from the line of Seth. They might be rulers of the people, like priests or kings or priest kings, but they're human beings. That's the most common opinion these days. It is not the most common ancient opinion. When you start looking at ancient Jewish sources prior to the time of Christ and surrounding the time of Christ, and even some early church fathers, they're unanimous that these are what we today would call angels who came down and fell. Now, in terms of the idea you mentioned that the angels fell basically at the first moment of their existence, you know, God creates them, they make a choice, and then they're locked into that choice, that's not church teaching. If you look in the catechism, that's a very common theological opinion, but it's not actually church teaching that this happened at the moment of their creation. The church does hold in the catechism that their will is such that now they're locked on course. If they chose evil, they're still locked on evil, and that's why they don't get forgiven. It's not that God's not willing to forgive them, it's that they don't want to be forgiven because of the way their will works. But if you read what the catechism says about when they fell, it just says it was in the past. It doesn't specify a time. So this is a matter of opinion rather than a matter of certainty. One option would be to say, well, maybe books like Enoch and Jubilees, which mentions the same thing, are right. Or maybe they're communicating something in a kind of symbolic way, but it's not meant to be taken literally. Or maybe they're flat wrong. You know, because as you say, they're not in the Catholic Bible. By the way, I have episodes of Mysterious World coming out over the summer about both Jubilees and Enoch, so you can hear what I have to say in more detail about that. I've also already had an episode on the Nephilim, which is episode 87, so you can go to mysterious.fm/87 and listen to what I had to say about them. And in that, I cover St. Thomas, among other things, St. Thomas Aquinas's explanation for how a demon that doesn't naturally have a body could nevertheless impregnate a human woman. And he says the result would be a human being. So he had a theory about how that can be accomplished, but there's the music. So I would suggest that you go to mysterious.fm/87 and you can hear all about what I'd have to say on all this, including what St. Thomas Aquinas said in more detail.
Christina, thanks very much for that call and that question. Hey, the lines are full still, so if you're on the line, stay on the line. There'll be one line open, so maybe two. So if you haven't dialed yet, go ahead and dial 888-318-7884. We will continue with Jimmy Ake in the second hour. Ask me anything. 888-318-7884.